first. Chair.
Well, you and Representative Kenny Geyer are here, so, and lively, so
we can roll.
1, 2, 3, 4, well, we don't
have a public hearing.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order for May 6th. And open up a public hearing on 71, 505, and 901, only for the purpose of gathering testimony from the chair of the Senate committee, who has some of our bills there, so we'd have to be nice to her.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Monas Anderson. I represent Gresham, Trout, Deadwood Village, and parts of East Portland. And I want to be very brief. All of these bills, I think we worked really hard on. If you have any questions, you can always ask me later. But I do want to talk on Senate Bill 71. It's dealing with the prescription drug monitoring program, which is a web-based system for Oregon's pharmacies to submit data on prescriptions for all Schedule 2, 3, 4 controlled substances. And these are drugs designated by the federal government to have really a high potential for abuse and psychological or physical dependence, such as morphine, oxycodone, and methadone. As you know, we have a terrible problem in Oregon regarding drug use of our prescription drug system. And a physician had contacted me from Bend, actually, and said the prescription drug monitoring program is not real-time data. And therefore, she didn't feel it was useful at all. And I think at some point in time, we really need to see how useful the PDMP is. But it was a week, and now it jumps to 72 hours. That was a compromise. I was hoping we could have a reporting done within 24 hours, but this is a compromise that we worked on over in the House side. So that takes care of Senate Bill 71.
And that 72 hours is for the pharmacy to put things into the database.
Yeah, they'll have 72 hours to report to the PDMP uses of that. And then Senate Bill 505.
And just a reminder, in the last session, we allowed pharmacy assistants, pharmacy techs, to do that, so it isn't the pharmacists themselves that.
And that was a request, too, from the providers finding, and I think that has helped some, but we will need to keep monitoring that to make sure that it's doing what it's supposed to be doing. I'll jump to Senate Bill 505 then. And it simply requires from October 1st through March 1st of each year, each hospital in this state must offer influenza virus to patients 65 years of age or older. I think most hospitals do that.
They're offering influenza viruses now, but we want to do influenza vaccination, right?
Was that what I said? I meant influenza. I'm trying to be quick. And I'm putting things on the record that aren't right. Okay. To offer the influenza vaccination to people ages 65 or older. And so most hospitals are doing this. However, this bill will standardize this practice in Oregon. So that takes care of that one, and I'll move on to the price transparency. As you know, we got an F on price transparency for our hospital charges, and so we actually had two different bills, and one did not get out of committee, which Senator Steiner Hayward is having a work group to try, and that was Senate Bill 891, and Senator Steiner Hayward has a work group working on that. But basically, this is taking a step in the right direction. The hospitals, it is a hospital bill, and it would require average prices for the top 50 most common hospital surgeries and the top 100 most common outpatient procedures to be in one spot. So this is a step in the right direction. I think we have a lot more work to do, but in order to keep the costs down and to make sure that the hospitals are...
Senator?
Yes.
That's not what the bill does, I think.
Senate Bill 901 requires bills.
The direct payment.
No, am I on the wrong bill? I'm sorry. Senate Bill 901. It's I'm sorry. I was jumping to the transparency bill, which is 900 instead of 901. I apologize. Okay. Senate Bill 901. This is in when companies who don't have contracts with hospitals, they have been sending their billings direct, or their the payments. The carriers have been sending their payments directly to the patient. And in many cases, the patients then spend that. And we had examples of a $12,000 payment. And I think there was a case even more sent to the patient. And then when the provider went to collect, they didn't have the money.
I understand the Las Vegas Tourist Bureau is opposed to this.
And this isn't the first time that this has been in front of us. But I thought that this would be... it just made sense, at least to the Senate. With that, I will conclude my testimony.
Are there any questions, of the Senator, on these three bills? Representative Hayden.
I have a quick question on Senate Bill 505. Thank you for your testimony. A lot of times in hospital settings, there is lots and lots of paperwork presented to the patient, and they basically sign all this intake information. On our advanced directives, we have notification in big letters on the top of those that say you do not have to fill out or sign this form. Would that be also implemented in Senate Bill 505 for people so that, you know, it just doesn't get bundled up in a bunch of papers and they sign?
I would have to have the hospitals, they would be better able to answer that question, but that would be reasonable to me.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Miles Anderson,
thank you very much
for testifying.
Me to go quick and first.
Well, we'll go immediately to Senator Hansel next. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 121. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to Senator Hansel on this.
Okay.
This is the bill that relates to hazards and public health hazards, annexation related to public health issues. He can do a great job.
And Representative Smith has asked me to note for the record that he's sorry he's not here. He really cares about this bill. He felt the senator would be able to ably represent the team.
And would you like me to call the mayor of Milton Fillmore now or later?
If it would be possible, it might be good to try to get them on the line. They would like to testify as well, if that's okay.
Okay.
Mr.
Chair. Hold on just a minute. We'll...
Hi, Linda. This is Sandy Teeley Circa of the House Healthcare Committee.
Hi.
Hi, you're on speakerphone. Senator Hansel is at the witness table, and you have somebody else along with you to testify. Is that correct?
That is correct. I have Mayor Lewis P. with me as well.
Well, we'll start with the senator and move to the mayor, and if he would introduce himself when we get to him, that would be great.
Absolutely.
Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chair Greenlech, members of the committee. For the record, State Senator Bill Hansel, State Senator for District 29, located in Eastern Oregon. Senate Bill 121A comes to the House from a 30-0 Senate floor vote. Oregon law permits annexation of a territory in certain instances, such as when water quality is poor. A health hazard abatement process can be proposed by a city, local board of health, local boundary commission, or a petition of a local body of at least 11 residences in a territory. This is what happened in the case of Milton Freewater. There is a trailer park located about a mile and a half northeast of the city, outside of the UGB. Some residents petitioned to have a health hazard declared, and once that started, the county began looking into the situation and declared that there was, in fact, a hazard. When the county and the city figured out what the cost would be, some of the petitioners wanted to remove their name. They felt it would be cheaper to solve the problem themselves. The removal of their names, however, was not an option under current law. Forced annexation is very rare, but when it does occur, such as currently in the case of the city of Milton Freewater, this can be very costly and very challenging. Milton Freewater has a price tag of close to $15 million. This is because the mechanism for dealing with annexation provides few options of flexibility. Senate Bill 121 provides these options to a city experiencing a forced health hazard annexation. Senate Bill 121A allows alternative plans to be proposed. These include an increase in the number of residents who can initiate a proposal for annexation, permits a petition to be withdrawn or individuals on it, and includes cost analysis as a consideration to annexation. We have worked closely with Aaron Doyle from AOC to craft this legislation in such a way that would be beneficial for all cities in the state. We worked with OHA to craft a bill that would bring the department into a neutral state. There was not any opposition whatsoever at the Senate hearing. And as you know, Linda Hall, the city manager, and Louis Key, of the mayor of Milton Freewater, are available by phone to testify in just a moment as I am done. As Chair had mentioned, and I might add that Representative Smith fully supports this bill. He is a co-sponsor and would have been here except for another hearing. He also wanted me to place on the record that he would be more than happy to carry the bill should it move forward to the floor for a vote. Senate Bill 121A is truly a bill that will provide local options for a situation that currently does not have any. I am more than happy to try to answer any questions that you might have.
Can you hang in during your testimony? Then we can ask questions. Please go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Louis Key. I'm the mayor of Mount Freewater. I appreciate the committee holding hearings to consider our options and advantage of what we feel is this legislation. The amendment to add consideration of cost is very important. And Mount Freewater's current requirement would tax these residents beyond their ability to pay for the improvements. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're doing fine.
Okay, great. But with the ability to consider other options, then we could find more economical solutions. And an example of that to the little community of called Yuma Pine to the west of us, they had a similar situation, and they put in their own city improvement district and with a community well, and they took care of their own problems with their own resources. And a second important point is it allows a percentage of residents to consider the solution as opposed to a very small number of affected residents.
In that case
of 11.
Mayor, you mentioned an amendment. Is that an amendment in the Senate, or do we have it here?
It was in the Senate.
It was in the Senate. Okay, it's the bill as amended we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. In our case, we have an example to the west of Mountain Fair where there's community development system. Thirdly, the process, once it started, and it's determined by the affected citizens that the proposed solutions are not what they want nor can afford, this new bill allows some off-ramps so other kinds of alternatives can be considered and a more economical solution proposed. And the proposal is just a much better law for all parties concerned. It gives options for affected parties to solve their own health problems in a fair and equitable and cost-effective way. I appreciate you taking your time to hear our concerns, and we hope you consider our bill.
Thank you. Is there going to be another witness?
Yes, sir. Chair Greenlick and members of the House Health Care Committee, for the record, my name is Linda Hall, and I am the city manager of the city of Milton Freewater. The address is 722 South Main Street. As Mayor Key mentioned, we're a small city of just over 7,000 in rural eastern Oregon, for which I am representing today. First of all, I too want to thank you for hearing our testimony today. As I understand, this legislative session has been one for the record books, so I don't envy the amount of work that has been before you. We truly appreciate your time. I am testifying in favor of this important bill. This bill makes a critical improvement to the existing statute regarding consideration of solutions for remedying a potential or actual public health hazard. This bill and its amendment would allow many options to be considered to fix the problem, allowing compromise to take place and introducing common sense and reasonableness into the equation. This bill introduces cost-effectiveness as a criterion to be considered. Furthermore, Senate Bill 121A allows for a percentage of residents in an affected territory to petition for annexation rather than the current statute's standard of any number greater than 11. In Melton Freewater's case, 13 county residents began a process to force annexation and extend services that our small city would have been forced to figure out how to pay for. Vast majority of county property owners were not even in favor of. Senate Bill 121A offers off-ramps in the process that would allow petitioners to withdraw their petition if they so chose. The current statute does not have any provision to allow this. In conclusion, I urge you to give your approval to Senate Bill 121A. It is an important fix to an otherwise good piece of Oregon legislation that allows for multiple options to be considered to fix a health risk problem, introduces the ability to compromise and consider cost when strategizing about how best to fix a problem, and it gives all the parties involved, cities, counties, private citizens, even the Oregon State Health Authority, the flexibility to cooperate together to arrive at the best solutions for Oregonians to be safe and healthy. Thank you again so very much for your time and consideration. And of course, I would be happy to answer any questions the committee may have.
Well, why don't you hang in a moment? Let's hear from Ms. Doyle, and then we'll see if there are any questions.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Doyle. I'm with the League of Oregon Cities, and I worked with Milton Freewater and the senator and OHA on crafting this bill. I try not to repeat everything that just was presented by Milton Freewater, but essentially, we understand that the health hazard abatement process is very important for solving a problem of either contaminated water or septic leakage into a water supply, and we didn't want to undermine that process. However, we wanted to make sure that we're not sticking $15 million price tags on certain parties' heads. So I'll just explain a little bit. I picked 40% because when we were going through, we were looking at what would be a threshold that would be representative of the number of people impacted by any annexation decision, but we didn't want to set this threshold so high that it would be impossible to have a solution to find a solution to the problem. And so the 11 residents that's currently in statute might not be reflective of the amount of people who might be impacted by the decision to sign a petition. So we wanted to create that relevant size issue. In addition, we wanted the cost to be considered when it's the city presenting, because the city is probably going to have a more realistic expectation or knowledge of what it costs to extend infrastructure versus doing some other alternative solution. And finally, the last fix was very important. The way the statute was written, consideration of an alternative solution is already permissive. However, when proving up that the work is going forward to OHA, the options were showing that you have annexed or were in the process of annexing, which if the alternative solution was not necessary to annex, it seemed odd to require the annexation. So we added an additional way of proving up that changes are being made, that is showing that you're making concrete steps towards enacting that alternative solution. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and good bill should pass.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the panel?
Lively. Thank you, Chair, and I've talked a little bit. And so I just need to understand a little bit clearer about kind of the final authority, and I appreciate if they're under orders because of a health authority. So in this case, it's not a city, it's the people located outside of the city. Then who ultimately is the final authority to decide if the alternative plan or what's been proposed is acceptable to all parties?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively, OHA or DEQ, depending upon who's overseeing the process, has the final authority to determine if the alternative solution is the best solution.
And can I follow up, Mr. Chair? So then the question from my standpoint becomes, and I think all this makes great sense, I'm just concerned at the end of this, the financial liability or responsibility for members of a community So going back to what the solution might be, if the solution involves some kind of extension of services or provision of services, then what's the ability for citizens of that community that may have already paid for those services themselves to input or have a part of the discussion about whether that is a solution acceptable to them or not?
Chair Greenluck, Representative Lively, I think in part the answer is going to be that the local government will be, when crafting that alternative solution, will be trying to have a very public and open conversation because it is their budget and their citizens that would be impacted. I'm sure that the mayor or Linda could answer how that question is being addressed in Milton Free Water and specifically if they would like.
Any other discussion?
Chair Greenlink and Representative Lively, that's where the city elected officials that are to represent the people would come to play as to whether or not is this reasonable, and they would be able to give that input. Right now, they don't have the opportunity. It's a forced annexation, and nobody has a chance to say anything. But I think it most likely would be through the elected body and or the county commissioners if it's in the unincorporated area.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're not working bills today. This will be probably Monday.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you all very much. I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 121 and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 71.
I'm going to... Linda and Mayor, we're done with the hearing now, so I'm going to hang up.
All right. Thank you very much for the accommodation.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 145A. Madam Administrator, what do we have there?
Uh-huh. 145A defines small employer as an average of at least one, but not more than 50 employees during the preceding calendar year. This left the Senate floor with 23 ayes, 6 noes, and 1 excuse. And we have 2 people to testify, Mr. Chair. Minimal.
Would you please call it down?
Sure. And this has a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact on the bill. Tom Holt and Doug Barber.
Frequent flyers. Special privilege. Is Doug here?
Chair Greenlick, I think Doug is elsewhere in the building at the moment. He said he would get here if he can. For the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions here in support of Senate Bill 145. This is a fairly straightforward bill dealing with an issue that's sort of in the air federally, and that is when the small group market will change in employer size. Currently, under Oregon law and in most states, small employers are defined as 1 to 50 employees. Under the ACA, if all continues as is in rule and statute, that group size limit will change to 100 next year. However, there is a tremendous amount of chatter federally about potentially delaying that. And so what this bill does is give DCBS the flexibility to flex with the rest of the country if the federal government does decide to delay the implementation of this, what we refer to as the small group expansion. If this bill were to pass and the federal government does nothing, just as we all learned in high school civics class, the federal law still would prevail and we would be increasing our size up to 100. But this was necessary because in one of our previous rounds of ACA, Affordable Care Act alignment legislation, we had put the small group definition in Oregon law to be exactly what the ACA says. So as matters stand now, if the federal government were to flex, we would not be able to unless we adjust our own statute. So we're here for that. We have been having discussions with DCBS on this, and we may end up fixing this issue in a bill that already came through this committee and is now on the Senate side, but both we and DCBS desire to keep this one alive as a vehicle.
That's a complicated bill.
That's a really big, complicated bill. Yes, 2466.
The whole bill.
Then. Yeah. Okay. So our desire is
that would be a good place.
Is to hold this in your committee for the time being while we work with DCBS on deciding which bill is the best place to take care of this issue. Just had discussions with them as recently as this morning, and we're agreed on that recommendation.
Mr. Barber.
Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters in support of Senate Bill 145. As Tom said, what we're looking for is this flexibility, and what we don't want to happen is for the federal government to delay the expansion of small group and Oregon to not have that flexibility, so that all of a sudden we're at 2 to 100 or 1 to 100 and the federal government's at 1 to 50. What, for those of you who were around when small group expanded from, used to be 2 to 25, it went up to 2 to 50, and there was huge rate shock that rippled through small businesses. Many of them, you know, saw 40, 50, 60% rate increases. There is an expectation we may see some of that again when we expand from 2 to 50 up to 2 to 100. You're going to see businesses in that 50 to 100 range with some big rate increases. And so we don't want to go through that if we don't have to. If the federal government says we do, we do. But and we'll, you know, try to cushion it as best we can. So we just think this is a prudent step to take. And whether it's in this bill or in the big ACA compliance bill, at the end of the day, doesn't matter. We just want to make sure it happens. Thank you.
Any questions? Yes.
Chair Greenlee, without going into a four-hour session here, what is the biggest drivers of those rate increases when that jumps?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Hayden, there are a few big moving parts here. For the employers that are now 51 to 100 who will be becoming eventually part of small group, one, they will be going to what we call community rating. So rather than having their rate determined by their actual experience of their group, their rate will be determined along with everyone else in that pool of covered people. That's a big one. Another big piece.
I thought your answer is going to be insurance company greed.
Chair Greenlee, we're a nonprofit.
So, oh, I see.
The other biggest factor in this is that the benefits will change, in that in the large group market, employers have a lot of flexibility to decide some of the details of what their plan coverage will include. As they go to small group, they're going to be in for some of them, they're going to be in a richer plan and they're all cookie cutter plans approved by the state. There's no negotiating about what's in your plan or not. And the last piece is that the large employers do negotiate for rates. And in Oregon, where most employers are in the space of around 50 plus to 150, 200 employees, that's a tremendously competitive part of the market. And those employers benefit from putting things out to bid pretty frequently.
I also think it's safe to say that when you move from experience rating to community rating, there are winners and losers. There are some people whose rates will go down, assuming it's the average of that whole population.
Chair Greenlee, that's correct. There will be some winners. What we've seen, and the DCBS did do sort of their best estimate of what would occur, and the chart they had was, you know, bars that had extremes kind of at both ends. And, you know, as Doug said, what we worry about is those that get extreme rate shock just leaving the market. That's a risk.
Any other questions? Great, guys. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you, sir.
We'll wait to hear from you. What happens if we pass both of them?
Chair Greenlee, if we pass both, then there will be conflict amendments would have to be done on the bills.
Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 14. I'm sorry, Senate Bill. I'll get to that soon. Senate Bill 145A, and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 153. Madam Administrator, what have we got there?
Well, Mr. Chair, this bill clarifies the definition of independent practice for the purpose of the insurance reimbursement for services provided by a licensed physician assistant or a certified nurse practitioner. We're going to invite Dr. Rick Kincaid up to give the committee an update on the report from the Task Force on Primary Care and Mental Health reimbursement that conducted many meetings this past interim. He'll lay the groundwork, and then we'll have Sarah Basler come up and speak to the bill.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to address this body. My name is Rick Kincaid. I'm a family medicine physician in Eugene, Oregon, and I serve as the co-chair.
Wait a minute, can I interrupt you? We have a senator who's showing up on time. I had no understanding. How about you coming and testify?
Are we on this bill?
No. We'll open up another bill.
We'll let the doctor face
that. Okay, great.
Very good.
Thank you, Senator Bates.
Chair Greenlee. As I was saying, my name is Rick Kincaid. I'm a family medicine physician from Eugene, Oregon, and I currently serve as the co-chair of the Joint Interim Task Force on Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement. This task force is comprised of physicians, nurse practitioner, physician assistant providers, as well as insurance representatives and legislators. I am here to fulfill the intent of House Bill 2902 from the 2013 session in reporting the findings of the task force from their deliberations over the last 14 months. I believe you have a copy of the full report of the task force. Our task force was primarily to examine three aspects of payment for services. The first was fairness of existing payment structures as they specifically related to the differential payments of physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants. Secondly, how payment structures and other efforts could specifically support future primary care and mental health workforce needs. The last aspect was what alternative payment models are now being considered to enhance primary and mental health care delivery. I'd like to provide this committee with the highlights and the key findings from the work of the task force. First of all, with respect to fair payment practices for providers, the task force found that there were inequities that existed prior to the action created by House Bill 2902. However, over the last 16 months, insurers have built processes to be in compliance with these new regulations. The task force, insurers, and regulatory bodies have requested clarity in the definition of independent practice. And thankfully, that process is, in fact, occurring today, given your committee's deliberations concerning Senate Bill 153. There was also an evaluation requested with respect to the compliance of the law that has just now been completed by the Department of Consumer and Business Services and will be presented actually to the task force next Friday. We recommend that the sunset clause, which was stipulated in 2902, remain in place until the task force is confident that there's full compliance with the current law. The second aspect we were asked to look at was support for primary care and mental health workforce. And the task force recognizes that there are significant provider shortages in many communities across Oregon. The reason for these shortages are multifactorial, but largely economic. The task force is confident that the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Health Policy Board's Health Care Workforce Committee is adequately addressing this issue, and other than efforts to improve payment structure for primary and mental health services, further committee discussion related to this issue is not necessary. The task force does recommend continued efforts to provide loan repayment as well as increasing funding for existing residency and advanced practice training for primary and mental health care services. Lastly, we looked at alternative payment models, and the task force acknowledges the work that was commissioned by the Oregon Health Authority to study alternative payment models. They outlined several key findings. Alternative payment models can be effective in increasing quality and decreasing cost. There is support across the state for continued implementation of alternative payment models, but there is no one-size-fits-all model. Reform efforts need to continue to be at the local level, need to involve all stakeholders. The task force recommends continued efforts to create a uniform multi-payer payment model for primary care medical home, as well as continuing to study the impacts of alternative payment models currently being utilized in the CCOs across the state as to their effectiveness in improving health outcomes as well as reducing costs. Finally, the task force recognizes that once it is assured of the intention of House Bill 2902 is fulfilled with respect to fair payment, there may be a need to reconfigure or redeploy the task force members to specifically address the complex issues related to payment reform. In the coming months, we anticipate further recommendations from the task force concerning both the sunset clause and the future utility of the task force. I would like to thank my co-chair, Mary Grant, as well as the members of the task force for their commitment in examining complex and broad set of issues and for their dedication to improving the health care for Oregonians. I'd also like to thank our staff support for the task force, Sandy Thiele Circa. I'm happy to answer any questions for the committee. Thank you.
And I'll see if there are any questions, but I hope we'll be able to call on you as the rest of the session goes on as we begin to...
Representative, yeah, my pleasure.
We're going to grapple with this problem. Are there any questions for now? Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlee, a quick question. I see that this clarifies the definition of independent practice, which you spoke to, but the relating to clause is relating to the reimbursement of primary care services. So the question is... if a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner is working for a physician group on a salary basis rather than a fee-for-service encounter data widgets, if you will, would they fall underneath this, or would there still be disparity in that situation?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, I believe we will be discussing the Senate Bill 153 subsequently. My understanding of the independent practice provisions is that person actually would not be considered in independent practice as they're billing under the entity which for which they're employed. That there will be further discussion, I believe, coming forth.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
I just want to put a bookmark in this chair.
We also appreciate your work on this whole thing. Not an easy task. I'm going to leave this hearing open, but I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 594 and ask Senator Bates to join us. What do we have here, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 594 left the Senate floor with 25 ayes, 5 noes. The bill specifies that a healthcare practitioner is not required to submit credentialing information to the Oregon Health Authority and that the submission is not a condition of authorization to practice until OHA has established an operational electronic system. This has no fiscal impact and no revenue impact, and we have Senator Bates. We have the panel before us.
Senator Bates, thank you very much for coming over.
Representative Greenlee, thank you for having me. Representative Greenlee, Chair and members of the committee, let me kind of walk through this real quickly for you so it makes some sense, I hope. This is really a IT fix for a bill that was actually passed last session. And what it drives to is this. When you're a health practitioner, whether you're a physical therapist, occupational therapist, an MD, a DO, an RN, nurse practitioner, you have to be licensed by one of our licensing boards here. They get certain basic information about you, where you went to medical school, and it's called a credentialing process. When you then go to a hospital to get privileges, or you work with an insurance company to be on their panels, you have to give them that information back again. And you end up doing this over and over and over again. And quite often, physicians are at two or three hospitals and they have to give them the same information three times. You got to do it every year or two. And that basic information doesn't change much. It's always the same. And you spend hours and hours and hours of doing that, or your organization does it. This idea was brought to us by Mike Bond, who runs an IPA, an Independent Practice Association in Southern Oregon. And his job for his company is to do this. He got tired of doing the same thing over and over again. His concept was, let's put all this into a data bank in a central place that each of the licensing boards puts into, and then every entity that is involved, as long as that practitioner gives them permission, pulls that information out. You don't have to do it over and over again. It would be huge savings to the overall system to do this. It was a bit of a challenge last session to get everybody together and agree to how we would do it. That was all accomplished. The plan was that we would have a IT system up and running by the time we came back into session here. As you may not be aware, but most people are, we've had some IT issues in the state about health care. And so I know it's shocking. I'm sorry to tell you that, guys. It's just a shock. But we've had some that also worked really well, too, the prescription management program, some others. What OHA told us, and Susan and others will tell you more about this, was they need a little more time to get this done. They don't want to rush this. This has been a system we've used for, the last 30 or 40 years. This is a big change for it. Instead of rushing into it and having a problem with the IT, they're using an off-the-shelf program. They're looking at it carefully. They want to build it properly, and they don't want to go live until it's really ready to go live, and they're probably going to need another 7 or 8 months to do it. This lifts that timing on them and allows them to get it done in a proper fashion, test it, make sure it works. The plan, I believe, is to bring on people slowly, step by step, probably one group at a time, make sure it works, then build a system out. It'll probably take a couple of years. In the end, it'll be a much better way of credentialing people. It's not licensing, but credentialing people and making it much easier for them to work with hospitals and insurers to get that information out quicker, easier, and frankly, a lot less cost to the whole system. So I'll stop there.
I remember we had a telemedicine bill that ended up requiring somebody at OHSU who was telemedicine with 12 different hospitals to get credentialed with each of the hospitals independently. That sort of stuff is really...
That sort of stuff just... You're right, Mr. Chair. That kind of stuff kind of drives you crazy, and we can do better than that with this program.
Yes, please.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Susan Otter, and I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm pleased to present to you today in support of Senate Bill 594. As Senator Bates mentioned, the Senate Bill 604, which passed in the prior session, created the Oregon Common Credentialing Program and required the Oregon Health Authority to establish that program and procure a database and a vendor to operate the program. The purpose of the Common Credentialing Program is to simplify and centralize the administrative processes related to credentialing. We have about 280 credentialing organizations in the state, which include such organizations such as hospitals and health plans and coordinated care organizations and ambulatory surgical centers. We also expect about 55,000 healthcare practitioners in the state will ultimately be submitting their information into the Common Credentialing Program to be used by those 280 organizations. Healthcare practitioners will be required to submit their common credentialing information into the system and to attest to or update that information every 120 days to ensure the currency of that information. Credentialing organizations will be required to use that program and the information in that program for their credentialing decisions. And they're able to ask practitioners for additional information that's not included in the Common Credentialing Database if needed, but they will not be able to go to practitioners independently if the data is already in that database. So it's really an administrative simplification effort, as Senator Bates mentioned. I'd like to talk a little bit about our progress since Senate Bill 604 has passed. Over the last year, we've created the Oregon Common Credentialing Advisory Group and engaged other stakeholders to establish the program. Some of the activities we've completed is we put out a request for information and received 12 responses from vendors who gave us information that will help us to develop the program and also develop the procurement.
We also determined the necessary common credentialing solution, functionality, and common credentialing requirements based on national accrediting entity and Medicare credentialing standards. We finalized rules for the program, and we're preparing to procure a vendor for the technology and operational solution. Senate Bill 604 requires the program to be operational in January of 2016, and we're not going to make that date. Senate Bill 594, this session, removes that date and replaces it with the requirement for OHA to establish an operational date through rule and give the users of the system at least 6 months notice before that operational date so that they can prepare for their mandatory reporting and use of that system. Because Senate Bill 604 requires us to procure an IT solution, a database, and a vendor to operate that database, we're required to go through the new DAS stage gate approval processes for IT projects, as well as to procure separate quality assurance vendor services. And both of those efforts have taken longer than we expected based on the original date in 604. Flexibility in the implementation date will ensure that a sufficient amount of time is allowed to allow us to implement the common credentialing solution methodically and properly so that it meets the expectations and needs of our stakeholders. Thank you for your consideration of Senate Bill 594. We look forward in pursuing this work to ensure that we have an efficient common credentialing solution that meets the needs of our stakeholders in Oregon.
We're glad to take any questions. Are you going to lead us into this a little more?
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Kevin Iwanchina, Chief Medical Officer within Samaritan Health and Intercommunity Health Network CCO, located in Lynn, Benton, and Lincoln counties. I'm also a practicing physician and on the Executive Committee for the Oregon Medical Association. But for the past year, I've been participating as co-chair on the Common Credentialing Advisory Group led by the Oregon Health Authority. This advisory group is in support of Senate Bill 594. The advisory group has been working with Oregon Health Authority on the implementation of the Oregon Common Credentialing Program for well over a year now. And it is a robust group of stakeholders that includes representatives from credentialing organizations, practitioners, health plans, and provider practices. And together, we are assessing implementation issues and provide advice to the Oregon Health Authority. As Susan Otter already stated in her testimony, the advisory group has made great progress to date. We would like to see the program fully implemented successfully. This means we need to ensure an appropriate amount of time in order to build the detailed operational activities necessary and carefully procure an effective vendor to deliver the common credentialing solution that we need. Once implemented, the Oregon Common Credentialing Program will provide benefits to practitioners, hospitals, health plans, and health systems, as well as other entities. As a proud physician in the state of Oregon, it is my chance to say thank you to you, our elected officials, in paving the way for better health for all Oregonians. I've been in full support of the initiatives of the Oregon Health Authority, the CCOs, and the need for administrative simplification. The current process for credentialing is cumbersome and repetitive resources, and the Oregon Common Credentialing Solution has been welcomed by many physicians that I have had the chance personally to talk about it. Having said that, there is a great need to have a solution that works well. And if there is implementation too quickly of a product that does not work well, we risk losing the support of our physicians and providers in the communities we serve. The staff at OHA that have been assigned to this project and the consultants hired have been instrumental that good lines of communication are in place between OHA and the Common Credentialing Advisory Group and other key stakeholders in the state. The Common Credentialing Advisory Group would like to ensure the implementation process is not rushed and it allows for an effective solution informed by stakeholders. We appreciate your consideration of Senate Bill 594 and are in full support. Thank you for your time and listening, and thank you for what you are doing.
Questions? I do. And I'm not sure whether it's a question or a comment. But let me ask a question first. And then I'll throw a comment. Is this being overseen by the state's chief information officer?
Chair Greenlake, yes, it is.
Do you have some estimate of when you ought to have a target for this? I mean, just opening it up open-end makes me very nervous.
Sure, Chair Greenlick. So we are, our current timeline for the common credentialing solution, we are on track to have the common credentialing vendor procured by the end of the year or shortly thereafter.
What year is that?
This year, by the end of 2015 or shortly thereafter. Once the common credentialing vendor is on, the estimates we received in our response to our request for information was a 6 to 12 month implementation phase. And so we are confident if we have our vendor on by the end of this calendar year that we would be up and running by the no later than the end of 2016.
And there's an October 2016 report date here, is that right, in this bill?
I believe we have a January 2016 date in the bill to report, as well as an October
report date as well. All right. Well, thank you very much. Sorry.
Kenny, go ahead.
Well, there are three other questions, I think.
Representative Bueller?
You asked my question, the timing of when it would be complete.
Yeah, I do have to say, this doesn't seem like all that complicated a system. I may be misunderstanding it, but...
The complexities...
What are the complexities?
When you get into these kind of systems, and everyone else has been using other systems of their own, each hospital's got their own, forms are all a bit different, licensing board's a little bit different, they all draw from common knowledge, but to get everyone on board and to keep them on board has been a real trick at times.
So it's not an IT complexity we're talking about.
It's political and IT. Now I think we've gotten down to being IT. So do you think that's basically it now?
You have a fixed design now?
And a good doctor may have a better feeling for that, too, having been on the committee.
So, Chair Greenlick, some of the delays that we've faced have been in getting the required quality assurance vendor on board. We've had some false starts with working with the quality assurance vendors that are prior approved by the state, which is a list that we have to work off of to get our quality assurance vendors. We now have a quality assurance vendor on board, and their review of all of our requirements and project documentation is required before we're able to move forward. So we have the initial risk assessment completed from that quality assurance vendor, so that hurdle been passed, which is very, very positive.
But that's taken quite a bit longer. My bill to put that in place, so I guess I hoist on my own petard on that one, but I think it is good to have that happen. Well, great. Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So there was a bill, 2231, by Representative Nathanson on credentialing, streamlining credentialing for organizations that are providers to CCOs. Is there any overlap at all between these two areas? Yours is credentialing of individual health care providers. That one was for organizations.
For mental health providers to CCOs.
So there's no overlap in terms of the committee or IT or anything else. They're two independent.
Co-Chair Greenlick, Representative Kenny Geyer, the differences, as you mentioned, that the common credentialing solution is for practitioners and the one that you are indicating is for organizations. However, we're all part of the Oregon Health Authority, and we're coordinating to ensure that we're aligning and where there are overlaps or ways that we can leverage the data from one solution for the other, that we're doing so. So I don't have a...
So they're aware of each other?
Absolutely. In fact, we've begun monthly meetings between the two project teams.
Okay, great.
Are we done with this? Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could, please. I just have a question. This is a great idea. I think we ought to be doing it, and I appreciate the efforts it takes. But so I assume the money for this venture was allocated during our current budget cycle. I'm just concerned about the length of time it's taken to get there and whether we're, at this point, given our track record, we're comfortable that the amount of money allocated and indicated will indeed fund the program.
So, Co-Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively, the common credentialing solution in Senate Bill 604 is to be funded by fees.
Okay.
Fees cannot be collected until the solution is operational. So we are floating until, so to speak, I don't know what the technical term is, until we have those fees established. And that is something that the Common Credentialing Advisory Group is our stakeholder group advising us on the fee structure and overseeing and providing input on that process.
Perfect. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hey, thank you.
If I may follow up with that also, Mr. Co-Chair, or Mr. Chair, the savings to the systems once it's up and running will be far more than the fees. And I may have my information outdated also, but I don't think any other state has this other than Arkansas has a partial one. Is that still the case, or have other states picked up on this now?
There are voluntary credentialing solutions in, I believe, in Washington State, and there may be one other.
Well, I think, if I remember right, they weren't functioning well because they were voluntary.
That's my understanding.
Thank you. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 594. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 281.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Did you want to finish?
That's right. We're still on 153.
We still have one more individual.
I'll leave the one open. I just opened, but we also have Senate Bill 153 open, and Ms. Bessler is going to talk to us about the bill specifically. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlee and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association in support of Senate Bill 153. I want to also thank Dr. Kincaid for his leadership on the Task Force on Mental Health and Primary Care Reimbursement, as well as all of the members who have put their time and volunteer energy into that task force over the past number of months. Senate Bill 153 is a technical correction to the payment parity legislation that passed in 2013. That underlying bill responded to a series of cuts from insurers to the reimbursement paid to nurse practitioners and physician assistants. The bill required private insurers to reimburse nurse practitioners and physician assistants the same rate as physicians when the NP or PA was providing the same primary care or mental health service and billing using the same code. The bill also included a definition of independent provider, which specified that in order to be eligible, in addition to the service having to be primary care or mental health and billed under the same code, the provider also needed to bill under their own name and their own personal national provider identifier. In the implementation phase of this legislation, we encountered a little bit of a glitch, which is why this bill is before you today. While the universal claim form requires both the provider's national provider identification number as well as the facility's national provider identifier, in some cases the insurer processes the claim based on the facility NPI, not the provider NPI that was mentioned in the definition in the underlying bill. We've done some work with the insurance division and have found that because the definition is in statute, when a claim is processed based on the facility NPI, it's not required to be reimbursed at the full rate. There is an amendment to this bill that responds to a concern raised by one of the insurers that simply states that insurers can continue to require both the personal and the facility NPI on the claim form. Dr. Kincaid mentioned that clarifying the definition of independent provider was among the recommendations coming to you from the task force related to the underlying bill.
Are those amendments coming to us, or are the amendments already in the bill?
The amendments are not yet in the bill. It's the dash one that you have.
We should have
here.
We do have the dash one, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes. We believe that Senate Bill 153 implements the recommendation of the task force to clarify the definition of independent provider, and we urge your support of this bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Are there any other witnesses?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So thank you much.
Thank you.
We'll get to it next week. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 153, and I have already opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 281. What do we have, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 281 modifies the Oregon Board of Naturopathic Medicine Board term of office requirement, specifies that a member may not serve more than two consecutive full terms, directs the governor to appoint a successor before the expiration of the member, deletes the current requirement that a term begins July 1. This left the Senate floor 30 ayes. There is no fiscal or revenue impact on the bill, Mr. Chair, and Ann Walsh is here to speak to the bill.
Please join us.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Walsh. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Naturopathic Medicine. I'm here asking your support, Senate Bill 281. Currently, it can take some time to replace a board position, even if we start that process before an outgoing member's term ends. When that happens, the important newly appointed member's term starts to finish the outgoing member's term, so that it ends when that outgoing member's term would have ended. Thus, their first term is often short. It often takes 3, 6, 9 months for a board member to feel comfortable in their position as a board member. And so to assure that we get full benefit from our board members, who are all volunteers, and really it takes a lot of work on their part to make it happen, we're just asking that they be allowed to serve two full consecutive terms, rather than finishing out a term and serving a second term.
Sounds simple enough. Are there any questions? Simple. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, we'll be getting to next week now. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 281 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 474. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 474 permits the existing dental clinics for special needs children to be operated by a charitable corporation, as the bill specifies. This declares an emergency effective on passage. This has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, Mr. Chair. And we have three folks to speak to the bill.
Would you call the panel, please?
Jessica Adamson, Dr. Tessa Bradine, Christina Bodemer. I think.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Risa Bradine, and I am the Medical Director for Children's Services for Providence Health and Services. Thank you for the opportunity to express our support for Senate Bill 474. This bill is necessary because it allows nonprofit charitable corporation with an existing dental program serving children with special needs to own a dental clinic. For Providence, this means that we can continue to provide preventative and restorative dental care at our pediatric specialty dental clinic that's located on the campus of Providence Portland Medical Center. Caring for the poor and vulnerable is critical to our mission, and our caregivers working at Providence Child Center worked with the center's foundation to establish this clinic. They recognized a prevalent unmet need for oral health care among children with special needs, because many times the physical and mental conditions have to take precedent, and then also sometimes their conditions make providing dental care very challenging. Many of the children we serve have a primary diagnosis of autism spectrum disorders. We also treat a number of children who are medically fragile, having complex conditions that involve multiple organ systems. Other common diagnoses include cerebral palsy, seizure disorder, Down syndrome, various mental health diagnoses, including severe anxiety disorders. So providing this specialized level of care needed to serve the children, the majority of whom are Medicaid recipients, results in a practice that's not self-sustaining. Our Child Center Foundation provides substantial ongoing operational support for this clinic every year. And this financial picture was the largest barrier we faced as we explored a wide range of options to bring the clinic into compliance under the current statute. So identifying a dentist willing to take ownership of the clinic proved difficult, mostly because the clinic operates in the red. Creating a teaching clinic, however, we explored that. After further discussions, it was determined that constant rotation of staff would be very challenging for many of these children. And then FQHD partnerships became our most likely option, but the financial analysis did not work for them either. So a legislative solution was our last resort, and Providence is committed to continuing to serve these children. And we're really grateful to the Oregon Dental Association agreed to work with us to find a solution, which is an additional limited exemption to dentist-owned clinics. And we asked for the committee's favorable consideration of Senate Bill 474. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for
say,
the
who owns the clinic now?
Providence. Oh.
Illegally? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. How you guys followed the law?
Mr. Chair.
Not on purpose.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. Yeah, that's not always our our most shining moment here, sir. But this is why we are here. It's never our intention to operate outside of the law, and as soon as we found that we did have this problem, we immediately set to work trying to find a solution, with this being our absolute last resort. We really, again, appreciate the Oregon Dental Association being willing to work with us to find a very limited pathway here, and we also really want to recognize Representative Hayden and his willingness to work with us on this bill. The Dash 4 amendment represents some important language that we are very comfortable with, and so just really wanted to thank you, Representative Hayden, for your work with us.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee. My name is Christina Bodemer. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association, and I'm here to share the association's support of Senate Bill 474. So about a year ago, the Oregon Board of Dentistry alerted the association that there was a clinic in the Portland area that was practicing outside of statute. The ownership statute is actually part of the Dental Practice Act that we are especially protective of. We believe the relationship between a patient and a doctor is something that should be protected from outside entities, and that corporations should not be able to interfere with it. However, as we've realized in the past, there are some special exemptions that need to be recognized, and we feel that the Providence Clinic should be one of these exemptions. The clinic provides critical dental care to special needs children at significant cost to the clinic. And these patients are so specialized that if they weren't being seen by Providence, they would struggle to get care anywhere else. We really do applaud Providence's efforts to attempt to find a way to comply with statute without legislation, but as was mentioned, every avenue was explored, and this is really the only fix that there is. So we are very supportive of the fact that we need to create a narrow exemption in the ownership statute that allows Providence to continue doing their important and very generous work.
Representative Hayden, do you have a comment?
I have a question. Thank you for the work on the bill. I do have a question with regards to Oregon Board of Dentistry and Providence working for 5 years outside the statute. Typically, that would create some sort of censure and fine. Is that being forgiven in this situation if this bill is to pass, or is that going to still be on the books?
So without speaking on Chair Greenlake, Representative Hayden, without speaking on behalf of the Board of Dentistry, as far as the Oregon Dental Association knows, there will be no fines being levied. They were also dedicated to working on finding a solution to this outside of statute. It was just not possible.
And follow up, Chair Greenlake. And as far as Providence with the Dash 4, as far as I am aware and have been in contact with the bill sponsor, Senator Gelser, has there been any feedback that we need to further work on that, or are we good?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, we are fine with the Dash 4. We don't see any need to any further adjustment from the Dash 4.
Thank you. Kidding,
Well, just a question on both what the Dash 4 actually does, but also I'm curious why you still kept it limited to medically underserved children. So the current law allows to provide dental services to rural areas or medically underserved populations of migrant, rural community, or homeless individuals. It also allows exceptions for dental services by volunteer licensed dentists to populations with limited access to dental care at no charge or substantially reduced charge. This adds the category of medically underserved children with special needs. I'm just curious about why you kept it so narrow. I know that's who you're serving now, but is it while you're looking at amendments, is it worth it to include, you know, medically underserved people? I mean, the difference between that and the line above it is that you're tapping into OHP funding. The other one is volunteer practitioners. So I'm just curious, when we're trying to expand access and OHP, you know, we keep hearing about getting access to OHP dental care is limited. So I'm curious why this is such a narrow exemption that you're including.
Mr. Chair, Representative Geyer, Kenny Geyer, the reason why we crafted this so narrowly, again, we were focused on how do we bring this clinic, this population that we are serving today, into compliance, recognizing that we had been operating outside of compliance for a few years. So we, in working with the Oregon Dental Association, understanding that there is some very long-standing history with respect to this statute, we felt it was very important to focus on a narrow exemption, and that is, this is the population that we're serving. This is the mission for which the Child Center Foundation is really focused on today, and that's why we sought this exemption specifically around children with special needs. That's who we're serving, and that's why we needed this exemption.
Thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 474 and go back to the public hearing we had going on Senate Bill 901. And would you please call the next panel?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, did you have a comment?
No, we're good. Thank you.
Patty O'Sullivan, Todd Noble, and Evelyn Cole.
And if everybody would try and be brief, that would be greatly appreciated. We're making great headway. And are there a couple more witnesses?
Yes, then it will be Doug Riggs, and then after Doug, it will be Tom Holt and Elise Brown.
All right, thank you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Noble. I am the Mental Health Program Manager for Linn County Department of Health Services, and I've spent 25 years of my career managing mental health services for Oregonians that are in need of such care. I am here to support Senate Bill 901. In Linn County alone, the amount of loss of revenues from mental health, alcohol and drug, and other public health care services where reimbursement is sent to the patient and not to us, the provider, averages $50,000 to $75,000 annually. This loss of revenue places even greater burden on county general funds and the declining state general funds and federal funds for those that are in desperate need of health care services. The requirement of direct payment to providers will stem this loss through unreimbursed services and provide for more funding to be directed to those who are unable to obtain health care insurance or who do not qualify for the Oregon Health Plan under Oregon's health transformation. We are working with the Hospital Association to get an amendment drafted to assure it is the extent of this legislation to include drug and alcohol services and health care services provided through our public health programs. Senate Bill 901 provides a long-needed fix to the funding of mental health and alcohol and drug-related services provided by the counties. Please pass this legislation to stop the loss of local dollars for those who already have health coverage. Thank you for the opportunity to come before the committee.
There's another amendment coming, is that what you're saying?
I'll talk. Patty, I'll summarize the amendments.
Go ahead.
My name is Evelyn Cole, and for 7 years, I have been the CEO for Spine Surgery Center of Eugene. I also represent the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Association, asking you to support Senate Bill 901. ASCs are a win-win for everyone. The surgeons are able to choose their preferred method of treatment, their preferred implants for patients. Patients have no exposure to nosocomial infections. Their co-pays are much less at a surgery center than they are when they have the same surgery in a hospital. But even so, insurers often delay or deny contracts to an ambulatory surgery center. When that happens, they take the position that their contract, therefore, is only with the patient. And so when a surgery center sends a bill to the insurer for the surgery, the insurer sends that check to the patient if there is no contract in place with the surgery center. They also deny any information to the surgery center about the check that's gone to the patient or if a check was sent. The patients who get the check are very confused. They don't know exactly what the check is for, because lots of times there'll be more than one check that comes to them for that same surgery. And so they may keep the check thinking it's their out-of-pocket reimbursement for the expense that they've had. They may deny that they've even gotten a check, and because the insurer does not talk to the out-of-network surgery center, we can't determine if a check was sent to them or not. I wanted to give you a couple of examples of patients in our particular surgery center who have had issues with this. One was a woman who had a fusion while she was going through a very difficult divorce. Her husband was actually the insured person. The checks went to him. She was now in a homeless center and had no access to information about the checks or the coverage. And yet he kept over $20,000 in checks that were sent to him for this woman's surgery. In essence, the court said in the divorce decree that he was going to be responsible to pay for that surgery. And so he came to us after we started sending him the bills and said, but my insurance company, my policy says I have a maximum out of pocket of $8,000. So why should I pay you more than $8,000? And we said, well, because you kept the insurance money that was sent to you for payment for this surgery. We've now got him on a payment plan of $250 a month, and it's going to take him approximately 10 years to pay off this surgery. Primarily because we couldn't get information about what the insurance company allowed or what they paid. So I would just ask you to support this. It's not only confusing for patients, it's demoralizing to surgery centers who can't make payments, make their bills, if their checks go to the patients. And so we ask you to support this.
Thank you. Ms. O'Sullivan?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I represent the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. The Hospital Association requested this bill, and the House Health Committee was gracious enough to sponsor it through Senator Mona Anderson. One person that couldn't make it here today that did testify on the other side on the House, I didn't have all the hospitals come. I'm Senate, sorry.
Thank you.
Sorry. On the Senate side is Shannon Bunyard from Adventist Health, and her testimony has been submitted online. When I went to see if it was posted, I noticed some other testimony was out there from nonprofits and some other counties, so you might want to go take a look at that. But basically, Senate Bill 901 has been brought, the issue has been brought before to the legislature, and a bill passed last session that the ASC sponsored that would make the payment be a two-signature check. The problem is the banks ignore that, and so people are still cashing them. And it's not just us not getting our money. That is a big issue, and that's why we're here. However, there's other issues that have come up. For instance, there was a student from the University of Oregon that I guess blew her knee out, had knee surgery at an ambulatory surgical center, might have even been yours. And her parents were out of state, and she was under their insurance because it covers people up to 26 now. So the check was sent to her parents, to her dad specifically, and he wouldn't pay the bill. But since she is over 21, the creditor, which was an ASC in this case, went after her because she's responsible for her medical bills. It ruined her credit for probably a long time to come through no fault of her own, because her dad would not send the money to the provider nor to her. So it does hurt other people as well as not paying the bills. This bill has, at this point, three amendments that are out there. Two of them have been approved through the group of people, insurers, and everybody that have been working on this, and that is 901A3. A3 is an amendment that Scott Berry, representing Aflac, brought, and it has to do with the fact that Aflac doesn't cover provider services. It sends a stipend to people that are hurt or sick. So it's more like a disability payment and should not have been included. And so this amendment would take that out. And that is great with us. The other one is the dash fours, and what that does is include A&D services along with mental health services to make it very, very clear, because the counties and the nonprofits that you can go out and read their testimony all do A&D services, mental health services. They do public health services, but they're really included in health care because it's the breast and cervical cancer and all those kinds of programs that the local public health clinics would do. So the A4, it needs a little tweak, but I don't know if it'll come back as A4, but the idea of adding A&D services is welcomed by everybody. There's another issue out there, and it's about third-party administrators who actually administrate, for the most part, self-insured. So there's varying legal arguments right now, lawyers battering back and forth about whether that would have to be done through ERISA or if we can actually regulate that. You'll hear some other testimony on that. The Hospital Association is willing to wait until the interim to see if we can do an administrative fix through the insurers. If that doesn't come about, we'll be back in 17, and we'll talk to you then about adding TPAs, third-party administration.
We'll be back in 16.
True, but the bill actually has an implementation date of January 1st, 17. So
we might not.
So we won't know by then.
Clean it up in 16. Are there any questions?
Yeah.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Greenwood. Thanks for bringing this issue to us. Our clinic and surgery centers experience similar problems, and it's an increasing issue. What is the opinion of the insurers, of the payers, with regards to this?
At the bill, at the
insurers,
they will be up here, but the A engrossed bill and the dash 3 and 4 amendments, they are neutral on the whole entire thing.
Am I follow up? We had difficulty with the insurer a number of years ago that we wouldn't contract with, and they used this as a point of leverage to try to get us to contract by not sending.
No, it's hard to imagine.
I think it was, anyway.
Representative Bueller, that's exactly why Adventist brought us the issue in the interim, was because they didn't contract with an insurer, and the same thing was happening as a motivation, I guess, to get them to contract.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. One quick question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. One quick question, which is kind of the flip side to this for the consumer part of it. In your example, with the $20,000, $250 payment monthly would be at a 9% interest. Is there caps when people get in these situations with significant medical costs? Is there caps on the interest rate that hospitals or providers can charge for that, or is it unlimited?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, there's really two issues, I think, that you're asking. One is if somebody accrues, let's say, a $10,000 bill, insurance has paid everything, the provider has gotten everything the insurance paid, and they still owe that. We actually have payment plans, but we also have according to income, and we make it as easy as possible. I don't have the answer to whether we charge interest or not and how much. But the thing we're talking about is the insurance payment was given to that person, and they decided to take their new knee to Hawaii to recuperate, and did not pay the provider for their new knee. So it's a bit different, and I'm not sure how we would handle that, but I doubt we would let them off because they did receive that money.
Let's go on. You're not answering the question, so let's have the next panel. And I believe the answer is no, there's no limit.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair?
I don't know.
All right.
Just trying to figure out what the problem is. What's wrong with taking the money and going to Hawaii and
that's
right. Recouping?
I'm one of the same thing.
I mean, doctors should be working for free, shouldn't they?
Absolutely. Can we have the next panel, please?
Yeah, I'm well. I've been doing that for a while.
You chose to be here with us.
Now you know what life is really like. Would you please call
Chair Greenlick, I was just told 9% is the cap without disclosure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Doug Riggs, Tom Holt, Elise Brown.
Two more bills after this one.
Once in a while you get it off.
Is that right?
Three.
Three more bills after this one.
I think it's three.
Two more.
505, 520.
Somebody's missing.
Elise Brown's not here.
Okay, go for it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. We very much appreciate you taking up this bill today. It's very important to our members. It's very important to my nonprofits with the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs, who end up thousands of dollars in arrears in certain cases. This was a bill that came out of last session, dual signature. This takes it down to a direct payment bill. This bill is necessary. It is not sufficient. As Patty O'Sullivan pointed out, it leaves out a huge potential issue, which is TPAs who work on self-insured plans are left out of this bill. And we had an amendment that we thought we were going to get to agreement on. There's been a lot of back and forth between the two parties. I think the legal arguments are pretty clear, but I do not want to hold this bill up, and so I'm happy to let it go through. Hopefully we'll be able to see some good behavior on the part of the insurers, and we won't have to come back in 2017 and fix this. But it really is a significant issue, and there shouldn't be any downside, in our opinion, to writing a check to pay for services that have been rendered. So I would urge your support of the bill with the two amendments that Patty mentioned, and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Doug.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt, Cambia Health Solutions. Elise Brown is in another committee at the moment. I know she intends to get here if possible. Here as Patty O'Sullivan mentioned, we've had quite a bit of conversation about this bill beginning prior to session with the Hospital Association and with the language in the base bill and the two really technical amendments that Ms. O'Sullivan mentioned. We are neutral on the bill with those two amendments. We would not be able to be neutral with an amendment dealing with third-party administrators. Third-party administrators administer benefits on behalf of self-insured health benefit plans, and those are regulated by the U.S. Department of Labor. That's a long-standing division between state and federal regulation, so we would urge moving the bill forward with I believe it's the A3 and A4 amendments are what Ms. O'Sullivan referred to. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Great. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 901 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 520. What do we have, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 520 permits pharmacists to administer vaccines to individuals who are at least 7 years of age. This left the Senate floor with 30 ayes, minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, and we have Sean Miller and Amy Valdez to speak to the bill.
So while they're coming up to the committee on Friday, we begin working some bills. The bills that are listed as public hearings and possible work sessions, as well as some actual work sessions.
Just public hearing, possible work sessions.
So we are meeting Friday.
We are definitely meeting Friday. We have 10 bills, and we'll work as many of those as we can, as well as hear them. So, yep.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Community Pharmacy Council, as well as the Northwest Grocery Association. And so in support of Senate Bill 520, which changes the vaccinations administered by pharmacists from 11 years of age down to 7 years of age. So I just want to acknowledge on all this, there is written testimony from the National Association of Chain Drug Stores. And at this time, Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Amy Valdez. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you. I, for the record, my name is Amy Valdez. I'm a licensed pharmacist in the state of Oregon. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists to urge your support of Senate Bill 520, which would lower the patient age for pharmacist vaccinations to 7. Initially, pharmacist vaccination efforts started with flu shots for adults, and today pharmacists nationwide vaccinate a multitude of vaccines across the lifespan. Currently, in pharmacists in 22 states may administer vaccines to patients of any age. Other states do have age requirements, which range from age 5 all the way up to age 19. There are 33 states that allow pharmacists to vaccinate under the age of 11, which is the current age allowed in Oregon. I'd like you to consider the following points in expanding pharmacist-administered vaccines by lowering the minimum age to 7. Immunization rates in Oregon are not where we would like them to be. This is a growing problem. It is an urgent public health issue, and it's going to require the cooperation of all of our healthcare providers, especially in light of recent disease outbreaks like the measles outbreak in Disneyland, and right now yet another whooping cough outbreak in the state of Washington. Extremely important that we have wide access for a wide range of patients. The pharmacy is becoming a more frequent site for vaccination, and recent research has shown that parents are supportive of pharmacists vaccinating their children. And in fact, in the states that allow that, children's immunization rates do increase when pharmacists are involved. I'd like to reassure the committee that the current gold standard training program for pharmacists already covers content related to vaccinating children and assessing the vaccine needs of children. We are already very familiar with using that immunization schedule. It is what we currently use for age 11, and we are already equipped to deal with adverse reactions for pediatric patients. In addition to that, pharmacists are also required to report to ALERT, the state immunization registry, and we are also required to consult ALERT before we vaccinate any patient. So we're very well poised and prepared to take care of these patients and be able to provide broad recommendations for these pediatric patients. In summary, this is not a substantial change to practice, and in fact, by prescription, pharmacists administered over 1,000 flu shots last year to children under the age of 11. So it's something many pharmacists already participate in, and it would positively affect immunization rates in the state of Oregon by providing additional access. I would urge your adoption of Senate Bill 520, and I'll take any questions.
Bueller or Kenny Geyer?
Representative Kenny Geyer, Representative Bueller next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering why you didn't lower it to age 5, especially because we have, you know, entry into school requires certain vaccinations. That seems like a population that makes a lot of sense. Other states do it. Curious how many states do 5 and 6, but just wonder how you arrived at the age of 7.
Yeah, I like that. It's a, you know, why 7? Why not 8? Why not 3? Why not 9?
What's the right? Because they're going into kindergarten would be my reasoning. Plus, it's not unheard of. Others do it.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kenny Geyer. Age 7 was chosen because it is a natural break in the immunization schedule. So there is a break between age 6 and 7 where below the age of age 7, you're actually still involved in completing the childhood series, whereas from 7 and up, it's catch-up vaccination and preparing for the adolescent schedule. So 7 was chosen for that reason because it is the bottom end of the schedule that we currently use in vaccinating adolescents.
Well, there's a reason. Good. Representative Bueller?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Greenlick. Can you tell me a little bit about the training program that pharmacists go through with regards to immunizations? Mm-hmm. Who develops it? When do they do it? How long it is?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, there are multiple training programs. So the Board of Pharmacy has the authority in the state of Oregon to approve which training programs are appropriate. The most common one is administered by the American Pharmacist Association. It is a nationwide certificate program, and it involves 20 hours of both didactic and classroom skills work, and is quite an extensive program. It is probably more extensive than many of the other training programs out there. It covers vaccine history, it covers all of the vaccine preventable diseases, and it also covers communication with patients, how to assess a patient, and then, of course, the technique required to administer a vaccine. The state of Oregon, or the Board of Pharmacy, currently requires that that training be completed before you start vaccinating patients, obviously. Many times it is completed during the course of pharmacy school curriculum. So I can tell you that in the state of Oregon, both pharmacy schools currently provide this program to their students who are matriculating through pharmacy school, and they complete that as students. But it is also available to any pharmacist as postgraduate curriculum. At this point, most of the pharmacists in Oregon have, at least community pharmacists, have gone through that additional training if they didn't get it in school, and many of them are currently vaccinating.
Mm-hmm. More follow-up, please. Who assumes liability, medical liability, for the pharmacist? Do they have carry insurance, or how does that work?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bueller, liability is, of course, on the practitioner who is administering. So in the state of Oregon, pharmacists are covered by Oregon Health Authority protocols. As long as we follow the protocol, we are exempt from liability in prescribing, because the vaccine is technically being prescribed by the state physician who signs the protocol. Pharmacists are, however, liable for administration and, of course, adhering to standards of practice. Anything that would be in the realm of negligence or not adhering to that standard of practice would fall on the pharmacist. Pharmacists are not required to, but many carry additional insurance beyond what their employer provides for malpractice insurance for that reason. And there is specific insurance which covers pharmacist errors outside of dispensing prescriptions for that reason.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Close the public hearing.
Just one quick one.
I guess my question, and something to think about, and I have to think about this on this bill, is I might be the anti-vaccination guy up here. It's not so much I'm anti-vaccination, but I think we over-vaccinate sometimes and have too many things we're vaccinating for. Can you see pharmacies actually going out and promoting vaccinations to things that maybe a child wouldn't need? Like, we do hepatitis B in infants, and I don't understand why we would give an infant a hepatitis B shot right now, where it would be something more in adolescence and things like that. And that's my biggest concern, commercializing this. And you're talking about more people getting vaccinated, but until we know if a child or somebody needs it, I'm just worried we could over-vaccinate. Has that been discussed at all by the pharmacy board or when you started taking this up?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, without getting too much into the clinical background, I'll tell you that the state protocols that we are mandated to follow, which are written by the Oregon Health Authority, are based on CDC guidelines. So the CDC or ACIP, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, set the guidelines for what vaccines are recommended, and then in addition to that, which vaccines are optional for both children and adults. So we follow the state protocols. The state protocols are written based on those CDC guidelines. And as healthcare providers, we advocate for vaccines.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 540. Since we're on a vaccination roll, we'll have a public hearing, or finish the public hearing on House on Senate Bill 505.
Yeah. Sean Miller and Patty O'Sullivan. Members, this was requiring that from October to March, each hospital shall offer immunizations against influenza virus to patients 65 years of age or older. This left the Senate floor 27 ayes, 1 no, 2 excused. There's no fiscal or revenue impact on the bill.
Go for it, guys.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of Sanofi Pasteur, which is a company devoted entirely to vaccines. And this bill, is, you know, again, it's been recognized for many years that people 65 years and older are greater risk of serious complications from the flu compared with young, healthy adults. During most of the season, it is estimated that 90% of seasonal flu-related deaths and between 50 and 60% of seasonal flu-related hospitalizations in the United States in people 65 years and older occur within that age group. Obviously, it's because the human immune defenses become weaker with age, so the flu can be a very serious disease for people 65 years and older. As Senator Modest Anderson described, this bill is just simply requires between October 1 through March 1 flu season of each year, each hospital must offer the flu virus to patients 65 years of older. Studies show that the flu shot can be up to 70% effective in preventing hospitalizations. And again, you have my written testimony on OLIS, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that hospitals, I think, are doing a great job in obviously promoting great job immunizing patients 65 years of older. However, I think passing Senate Bill 505 is actually just standardizes this practice in Oregon. I think if you look at the entire healthcare system, we all need to just try to do a better job of increasing the vaccination rates. If you look at Medicare.gov, when you compare the hospitals, one of the data points is patients assessed and then actually given the influenza vaccination. The Oregon average is about 87%. The national average is 93%. Again, some hospitals are way above the national averages. I think we just, again, anything we can do to improve. And again, I think this isn't this bill, we believe, just standardizes this practice, and we would encourage your aye vote. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Patricia O'Sullivan. I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We support immunizations, flu immunizations, but we are neutral on the bill only because we already have two metrics in hospitals. We do offer the flu vaccine not only to folks over 65, but to all of our patients. First, we assess if they've already had it. We also assess if it's contraindicated and they should not have it for medical reasons. And then we ask them if they would like one, and almost everybody says yes. The two measurements, one is by Medicare, so that would cover all the over 65, and that's tied up to the value-based purchasing program and has to do with the rate level that we get if you meet the metrics or not. The other metric is with the CMS core measures, and that's for all patients. So while we already do this, I'm not sure why the bill, but I don't think it will hurt anything, so we're not opposed to it. But so that's it. If you have any questions, I'll answer them.
Senator Hayden.
Chair Greenlee, same question I asked Senator Modest Anderson. Would either of you be opposed to having, in bold print, I think they call it 16 type print, advanced directive, just to kind of distinguish something to the effect that says you don't have to sign this form? A lot of times in admitting in hospitals, there's a large stack of papers, and the nurses go sign when we admit to the hospital. And so the advanced directive kind of sets that whole print apart. Would there be any opposition to that same type of language at the header of this form?
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, I'm not familiar with that. But again, the intent of the bill is to not have any administrative burden on the hospital or the doctor. So I guess if you're looking for an answer on if to ease any administrative burden, we don't have any issues with that.
Okay. Chair Greenlee, Vice Chair Hayden. So can I just make sure I'm understanding what you would like? You would like to amend the bill that has nothing to do with this bill necessarily, but does relate to the relating clause, and you would like to add something to the advanced directive that you, all right, then you need to explain. I don't understand.
The advanced directive is an example on those. It tells patients that they don't necessarily have to sign that form. When
okay.
they admit to the hospital, there's a lot of forms. Patients kind of get lost in the process. And so on that, they have in bold print, you're not required to sign this
form.
Talk
about all the admitting forms.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they're... I'm talking about admitting forms, but this process, wherever the hospital chooses to have that form presented, I'm not sure the bill lays that out. But when the hospital does present that, I'm asking if there's any opposition to having just in bold print that says you're not required to sign this.
Sign this to agree to a flu shot?
Right.
Right.
Oh.
Because the hospital will now be required to give them that option. They're not required to have the flu shot. Some may not
understand. That's correct. They're also, we are not also not required to have a form that they have to sign. So I don't know that it's relevant.
And we're not asking for one.
And that would not be.
How is the hospital then going to comply to guarantee that that was offered? Is this simply just in the
same
note?
I believe it would be the same way that we measure our metrics now and report them. It's put on their record, their medical record, in the medical record.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Hayden, I think the same thing, that matrix, that's concurrent law that shows different percentages of the hospital. Again, we're just asking that this is put in to standardize that, but I think it would be covered under that current metrics, too.
So if you standardize it, how do you get it standardized without a form?
Direct them. Well, Representative Hayden, it's a law, and they have to do it. I mean, hospitals are required to do a lot of
things. Put in the medical record that it's been offered and accepted.
Correct.
Yeah.
Offered and denied. Or that.
Yes, but that's already done, and I think the bill's asking for that to be standardized. But I don't think that's done.
The bill's asking to make sure that it's been offered.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, I think that you can tell from the statistics that we're probably not 100% now since we're 87%. So what this law will do is
80%, 7% offered or 87%?
I don't know where the...
I think that's offered, not having received it.
Correct, and they would be very different if that's the case.
And again, there's a wide range of the hospitals, other percentages, and so we're just trying to...
But the metric is about offering the vaccination, not right. vaccinating somebody.
Right. Correct.
So it means that 13% of the time,
the Representative Greenlee, they either say no or they've already had it,
yeah.
or it's contraindicated.
No, it's not they already say no, because the metric is offering the vaccination, even if they say no.
Correct. So the 13%
haven't been offered the vaccination.
Gotcha. You're right.
You're right.
Representative Buehler?
Thank you, Chair. Why do we need this law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Buehler, I think, you know, this is being pushed in many of the states around the country. It's been adopted in 13 states just recently, and then one by regulatory. I think any way to encourage, you know, a higher rates of immunization. It wasn't that long ago, 2012, we were 45th in the country from immunizing for influenza. So 45th out of 50 states. You know, I think obviously this bill, the last bill, I mean, I think anything we can do to promote, again, through all of our healthcare venues, I think is good for Oregonians.
You might ask Dr. Bates why he's a sponsor.
Well, I think there's, as Patty outlined, there's plenty of incentives now for hospitals to offer. In my experience, they're offered to every patient in the hospital. I think it's already being done.
Representative Buehler.
And the law's not going to change that.
You're correct. And one of the reasons that we're neutral, just to add a little fuel to the fire, is because the healthcare committees in the past sessions have had other bills in front of them about the flu vaccine and mandating that healthcare workers all receive flu vaccines, and they have been tabled time and time again. So we are offering vaccines to all of our patients, and sometimes it's to protect them from the very people trying to help them because they have not been vaccinated in many cases. So we find it a little bit of a little strange,
but it's mandating that you be offered.
Your record, we're 2 minutes late. We've done very well today. You've been very attentive. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 505. And as I say, Friday's agenda, every one of those is a possible work session. We'll work as many of them as we can without objection. And without objection, we are adjourned. And without objection, we are adjourned. That doesn't allow.